Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. Turkey has noticeably been strengthening its ties with Central Asia in recent years, and the process was especially noticeable in 2022. Russia's historic role in Central Asia is changing due to the Kremlin's preoccupations with the war in Ukraine, and Turkey is using its own historic ties to Central Asia to deepen its partnerships there in terms of trade and security. At the same time, Turkey's aspirations are opening new opportunities for the Central Asian states, as existing routes between China and Europe that pass through Turkey expand, and new trade corridors are being created. What is the state of Turkish Central Asia relations right now, and where is the relationship headed? To discuss all this, I am joined by Asel Tutumlu, a lecturer at the Department of International Relations and Political Science at the Near East University in Nicosia, and Mukhtar Singirbay, managing editor at RFARL's Kazakh service, known locally as Azatik. Thank you both for joining me. Asel, I'm going to start with you. Could you kind of give us an idea of how Turkish Central Asian relations have progressed this year?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a stark difference, actually, particularly since the independence, even though Turkey was the first country that recognized Central Asian states, and nonetheless, the relations were relatively, I wouldn't say they were stalled, but nonetheless, they were not a priority for many of the Central Asian states. Turkey was not necessarily the country with the largest investments. Turkey was not a country largest exports. And overall, politically as well, Turkey was not necessarily a priority, simply because, again, although in the 1990s, Turkey introduced Turkey introduced this idea of a brotherhood and Turkic nations and introduced some of the political forums, but nonetheless, it was not necessarily seen as a priority by Central Asian states and governments. On top of that, Turkey actually had conflicts with Uzbekistan because it hosted some of its opposition, and relations between two countries were not necessarily good. However, with the Putin's war in Ukraine, we have seen a very strong change and shift. And that shift has been so fast that it's actually very surprising. Particularly, the shift can be noted in the revival of various organizations that acquired not only its formal status, such as, for example, the Organization of Turkic States, but also in the in opportunities that Turkey offered concerning logistics, concerning supply chains, concerning exit to the international markets, to Central Asian states, together with or engaging, let's say, in various engaging different actors along the route, so to say, in a relatively successful diplomatic stint. On top of this, Turkey was also able to navigate between Russia and the West. It was also able to secure several important positions relating to the export of grain, for example, both Ukrainian and Russian grain, as well as the fertilizers through the Black Sea. So yes, it's been a very interesting and very dynamic year for Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Great. Thank you. Mukhtar, Kazakhstan is probably one of the biggest beneficiaries of Turkey's reinvigorated moves and engagement with Central Asia in terms of transport routes and in terms of security. Can you talk a little bit about how Kazakh-Turkish relations have developed? And before I let you say anything, I should also note that the Kazakh president Tokayev visited Turkey, and Turkish President Erdogan actually visited Kazakhstan. So this is a sign of how improved relations are between the two countries. But how are things changing in Kazakh-Turkish ties?
Yeah, thank you. Talking from the Kazakh perspective, it's changed rapidly within several months. If you can remember the January events in Kazakhstan in January, there was a big criticism about Turkey's role. I mean, when Tokayev invited CSTO, so Russian-led military organization, to help with a coup, if we can say it's an attempt of coup, So there were analysts saying that why Russia, why not other countries like Turkey and others? It was this kind of idea among the population as well. So, and it changed after the war in Ukraine when it started. As you say, as you already mentioned, there is a vacuum in Central Asia, vacuum of superpowers. And the people, especially the ordinary people who look for somebody who is outside, who is our brother, who is our relative, can help us, can save us from these giant superpowers surrounding us. And Turkey was the one who right there and to do that. And we see it from different sides, as you already mentioned. It's not only economic, but yeah, for now we see economic side more than the others, but the side of mental closeness, this brotherhood, it's more visible than the other sides. I mean, in terms of, if you can remember this symbolic photo of Erdogan receiving a map of this big Turkic world. And this was hugely discussed in Kazakh media, Kazakh social media, saying that, so we are again regaining this Turkic world. And it was thanks to this war in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up a little bit here with just one more question real quick. How much is the organization of Turkic states actually being talked about? Because, of course, this organization has existed for really almost 30 years under different names. The partners have kind of changed back and forth, but is the organization of Turkic states actually like a much bigger topic now than it previously was in Kazakhstan?
I would not say that it's a big topic. It comes up. Comes up to the agenda of the news agencies and news media only when something happens around it. I remember when the name was changed, there was a big discussion about, so it became an organization like a European Union or something like that, that can become a political, like powerful organization. There was a discussion that time. But of course, it depends on the triggers. If some triggering action, something happens, so we immediately start looking for this kind of savior, let's say, or brother. And it was discussed surprisingly during the, it was right before the 2022, when there was a war in Nagorno-Karabakh. So the war in Nagorno-Karabakh and the Azerbaijan became a winner, that was one of the moments when this Turkic identity discussions came up. And I remember the people started to draw a map saying that now Turkic world in Asia, in Caucasus, connected with our brothers in Turkey. Geographically, we can say that we are together. This kind of, it comes up from time to time. Especially when during the visits of presidents, during this kind of big statements. I remember when there was a statement from China saying that they will be protecting the territorial integrity of Kazakhstan. That was a big surprise. And the same was with the Turkey. So it's always Kazakh society is looking for something, some very big, powerful protection that protects us from Russia. So, and Turkey considers one of the most reliable.
Bruce, can I just follow up on this?
Yes, please do.
I'm just going to give you an anecdotal evidence about this identity discussion. I think I think in Turkey, the majority of actors are very much attached to their homeland, to the Altai Mountains, to Huns and Turks and all this authentic, so to say, lands of forefathers and the languages. But at the same time, they are not necessarily aware what exactly Central Asians look like. And I have been asked multiple times walking on the streets of, I don't know, Istanbul, Izmir, been asked, for example, things like, are you Chinese? Or are you Japanese? And so even though, and it's interesting because they look at me from the perspective of exotic person, being someone that has, you know, smaller eyes, for example. But when I say that I'm from Kazakhstan, then the situation immediately changes. And it, and they actually immediately say, wow, you are Kardesh. And Kardesh is actually a sister. And so it's a very interesting idea. I think I agree with Mukhtar that the idea of Pan-Turkism in general is a kind of a shared, desired knowledge. But nonetheless, this idea still exists. It's very ephemeral, and it exists somewhere in as an ideal, so to say, that is far removed from what is happening on the ground. For many of the regular Turks, Central Asia and the idea of Turkicness is not something that they would agree with it, but it's not something that they know. It's not present in their everyday life. So to me, I agree that it's an ideal that potentially attracts. It's a very attractive ideal, but whether or not it has the possibility of being real remains a big question. And I think here we need to talk about a very long distance between the ideal and reality.
Yes, yes, I agree with that. It's the same in Kazakhstan. I mean, in general, if we look for the brother in a political way, it's clear. But when we come to this idea of Turan and this pan-Turkic, union, it's very, very far away from now. Because even in Kazakhstan, people don't understand what is it and what Turan is and how we are, I mean, really connected. Yeah, if we say about politics, about protection, about defense, about economy, about pipelines, it's clear. But the other side is very, as you said, ephemeral.
Mukhtar, for the benefit of our audience who might not be familiar with the term Turan, could you explain that a little bit?
Turan is a concept that has a very big thick roots. It's a concept of unity of Turkic nations with a center somewhere in southern Kazakhstan, and with the idea that we all are equal, we all are people of Turkic nation.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I'm going to get back to you, and this question is in no way meant to deprive any of the Central Asian states of their agency, but from the Turkish point of view, it's obvious that President Erdogan has been trying to build something of like a new Ottoman Empire, right? You know, that he wants Turkey to be recognized as a great international player at the moment. So is his policy towards Central Asia with that kind of in mind? Or also, I've heard suggestions too that, on the grand chessboard of international politics, that he can't do much to influence what's happening in the northern part of the Black Sea. Obviously, he doesn't want to see the borders of the Black Sea realigned again, and it's unclear what's going to happen with Ukraine and Russia. So, unable to make a move there, he's making a move into Central Asia, which has traditionally been looked at as, people have made that unfortunate comment about it being Russia's backyard, but certainly Russia has a huge amount of influence. So is this, how do you see this? Is this part of his scheme of a greater, of the great Turkish country? Is it a counter move against Russia, or is it both?
Well, I think President Erdogan is very opportunist. And we have seen this, obviously, in his, for example, policies in Syria. We have seen this in his relations with the EU, for example, where Erdogan uses blackmail and the threat of migrants, releasing migrants back to Europe and so on. And he uses it as a tool and a political weapon. In the present, I think in the present situation, in the present context, he sees the opportunities both in Caucasus and in Central Asia where Russia can no longer deliver. And he can actually step in and use, by using his regional status, let's say, regional capabilities, he can potentially step in and be an alternative mediator or arbitrator or alternative party in the conflict between, for example, Armenia and Azerbaijan. He can be also an alternative party, for example, for in relations between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And he is doing this in an opportunist way. And the reason why I say that, because he is willing to not only support, so to say, the brothers, but also he's willing to make a sale. He is willing to make a sale of weapons. For example, we've known this very famous drone diplomacy where Turkey has delivered drones to multiple countries in the region, and they've used actually these drones in conflicts between each other. So Erdogan's policies in that sense coated, let's say, in the rhetoric of Turkicness, in the rhetoric of brotherhood, but the majority of activities are actually aimed at exploring the possibilities of influence, exploring the economic possibilities, as well as the military sale.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I continue?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Let me start from the anecdotal, as I said, the conversation. There was a visit of Tokayev to Turkey, and we had a discussion with one of my colleagues in Turkey, and I said that Erdogan called Tokayev his brother, and he will help, and he said, oh, he says this to everybody who visits Turkey, and he says, you're my brother and I'll help you, and that's something like that. And it's confirms what Asel already said, is that from my understanding, from what we have been publishing in our media, is that Kazakhstan, but Central Asia in general is one of the baskets in there. Turkey's geopolitical perspective in Eurasian continent, let's say. And from what Turkey is doing since the start of this war, so what kind of political games Turkey is playing with NATO, with the United States, with Russia, trying to be mediator, somewhere trying to be a big brother, and gaining, as you said, this opportunities in military, in other stuff. So it's just a part of this very big geopolitical game and geopolitical chance for Turkey to gain, to use this chance for the sake of its geopolitical interests. And this Turkicness, this pan-Turkism is one of the factors that help.
Okay. Thank you very much. You know, and we have reached the halfway point in our broadcast at the moment. So it's time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I am Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. We're talking about growing Turkish Central Asian relations, and discussing this topic with me are Mukhtar Singirbay, managing editor of RFARL's Kazakh service, known locally as Azatik, and Asel Tutumlu, a lecturer at the Department of International Relations and Political Science at the Near East University in Nicosia. Let's get down to some of the infrastructure, you know, down to the ground level of what's happening. Asel, you know, now that the Russian route has kind of been questioned, been disrupted coming out of Central Asia, and this affects not only Central Asia, of course, but China, a lot of effort's been going into getting goods between China and Europe through Turkey, as I mentioned at the start of the show. Can you take us through what are some of the new developments in the trade routes connecting Turkey to Central Asia and China?
Sure. So basically, the conventional route of goods that would travel from China to Europe using, so to say, the north route would take approximately 30 to sometimes 60 days, depending on the weather. And overall, it's a much bigger in distance. The same thing goes for the maritime route, because again, goods have to travel large distances before they actually reach Europe from East Asia. Whereas right now, the rail corridor that has been established is capable of transporting hundreds and thousands of containers using the rail link from China through Central Asian states, through the Caspian Sea, Caucasus, Turkey, and goes on to Europe. And that particular route has actually saved tremendous amount of time. In 13 days, sometimes in 18 days, but in 13 days, containers can actually reach from China. They can reach Europe. So that saves not only the time, but also logistically, it becomes much cheaper. And in addition to this, now we are expecting to see sometime in spring 2023, another connection, rail connection, that will be coming from Uzbekistan and will be added basically to the existing railway system. So that means that Central Asian states can actually be, and that rail connection from Uzbekistan is also connected with Kyrgyzstan. So that means that we are going to see more and more Central Asian states are actually linked to this transnational corridor. Some may actually look at it from the perspective of Belt and Road, because again, strategic rail in general, railroads, strategic assets. But it's not only part of the Belt and Road. Some parts were actually existed before. Some parts were newly built by the governments themselves. So this particular corridor is going to offer saving of time, costs, and the ease logistics in general.
Very good. Yeah, thank you very much, Mukhtar. Get back to you on this point too, because Kazakhstan earlier in the year, when they were having problems using the Novorossiysk port, President Tokayev said that we have to come up with some new routes. We have to have new plans. They're working on, I believe, a third railway, major railway, to connect China to the Caspian Sea, once they finish the Bakhti Ayagoz railway line. And I know that they've been doing port work. Can you talk about how much of the work, since President Tokayev ordered them, the government, to find new routes, how much of that effort has gone into these routes that lead to Turkey?
It was officially stated that diversification of the routes are important, but it's not the case of several years, right? Several months. And it's a very long process, and I haven't seen any developments. I mean, the developments that could say that, yeah, we are working on this position, on this direction. Yeah, fields that have used the Russian pipeline, they waited for a long time for the restoration of this KTK pipeline, and then when the problem is more or less solved, these diversification promises became not actual. But so we have been using the roads for a long time. It was reliable. It's now the only source, only like major source of exporting the oil. But the Baku Tbilisi Jihan, for example, and the other routes, as Sel mentioned, they are important. They know that it's important, but it takes a long time for them to plan. And especially here, we can see how important the role of China. And China might be interested more in developing it faster.
Can I also add here?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I was just going to say that actually for Turkey as well, I mean, Turkey has a very elaborate system of gas pipelines, for example. And what's important to note is that Turkey also suffers from Russian blackmail. Gas blackmail. So at times when Turkey acts in a way that's not necessarily conducive, for example, to Putin's idea or vision about how Turkey should act, frequently we have, for example, gas suspensions. So just recently in the Blue Stream, the Blue Stream was closed for 10 days. And again, just on a two-day notice. So suspending 60% of Russian gas to Turkey. And the same thing was done for TurkStream, but that can also be suspended because Russia is afraid of some terrorist activities, for example. It can easily accuse Turkey not necessarily providing adequate security to this infrastructure. And so that's why it's a very volatile, actually. It's a very volatile system, so that Turkey is also interested in acquiring alternative ways of providing natural gas. And if it is from TANAP pipeline, for example, which is relatively safe because it totally bypasses Russia, so be it. But again, in general, I think the issue of hydrocarbons Turkey remains very vulnerable to the whole issue of delivery and supply, of stable supply of hydrocarbons into domestic markets.
Okay, this is a good point. You know, and I just thought of something, so let me get back to Mukhtar for just one second. Mukhtar, can you tell me a little bit about the role of the Batumi port? Because we talked about Novorossiysk, but why hasn't Kazakhstan opened up? It owns the Batumi port. How has it been expanding its operations through that port? Well, you know, while we're waiting for Mukhtar to come back, I guess he dropped for a second. So you got any thoughts on that? Have you seen any action at the Batumi port?
No, actually, I haven't. So that's why I'm also interested in what Mukhtar has to say about it. But again, Tokayev, I think, recently announced as well the modernization of infrastructure, particularly the dry ports on the Caspian Sea, in order to, again, get alternative supply chains from Central Asia to the international markets. So there is a very strong realization that actually we do need to get out of this dominance between Russia and China. And we can only do that when we basically have the control over infrastructure. And that particular control is difficult because the railways have been, let's say, operated or under control of Nazarbayev's family. And Kazakhstan, for example, faces a tremendous shortage of wagons, which are, for some reason, half of them are actually in Russia. So with this said, I think for Tokayev, there is a very strong realization that there is a mess that we're facing. And in this situation, a stronger action and a stronger control over infrastructure, over supply chains is necessary and needed.
Okay. Well, we're waiting for Mukhtar to rejoin us again. The question I was going to ask you was the role of Azerbaijan and Ilham Aliyev. Actually, this is about Central Asia, but if you're going to get anything from Central Asia to Turkey, unless you're going to go the Iranian route, you're inevitably going to run into Azerbaijan. No, and I was going to mention and President Aliyev's role personally. He's also been to Central Asia a couple times this year, which is unusual for him. And Central Asian leaders, Tokayev was there at the end of August, I believe, also. So if you could talk about Azerbaijan's role and Aliyev also. Is he functioning as a middleman for Erdogan in Central Asia or on some level, or is this all on his own initiative?
I think there is overall understanding. I think there is an overall understanding that we are all in the same boat. And for Aliyev especially, he's been feeling not necessarily vulnerable, but at least there is on part of Azerbaijani government, there is a kind of unstable and uncertain situation in which, on one hand, Russia is involved or unleashed the war against Ukraine and therefore does not necessarily support adequately the army stability in the conflict with Armenia. You also have the proposals that are given by Turkey, and you also have a changing situation in the Armenian and Iranian relations. And so I think for Aliyev, there was a very strong kind of desire to at least have certainty with certain neighbors, with Central Asian states, have the desire and to have certainty regarding Russia, regarding Turkey, regarding the nature, again, of the supply chains. I think it's a great realization that we need to be moving together. So I don't necessarily see Aliyev as a middleman for Turkey. On the contrary, I feel like there is a growing regional connection and a regional need to cooperate and regional need to constantly match each other's policies, responses in a very highly volatile situation.
Great. Thank you very much. And hello, Mukhtar. Welcome back. Mukhtar, I have a question for you. We talked about the Novorossiysk port and the problems there, but Kazakhstan owns Georgia's Black Sea port of Batumi. Have they done anything to expand operations at that port?
Hi, I'm sorry. Yeah, there was an interruption in my internet. I haven't seen any developments. I mean, it was not officially said that there is a development in that direction. So,
okay, well, I'm going to ask you a follow-up then on that, because, of course, Kazakhstan has been talking about shipping oil, more oil, through Azerbaijan recently. A lot of it was on cargo vessels, tankers, but also this subject of the interconnector pipeline, which is an old project, like 20-year-old project, has come up. How much of discussion is there of that? And also, in terms of the Caspian Sea fleet, what's Kazakhstan's tanker fleet look like at the moment? How much do you have any idea how much oil it can move across the Caspian?
There was an information when the Russian pipeline was stopped for a while for technical reasons, and it happened several times. There was a discussion. There were statements that the other roads would be used and would be developed. There were promises, but as I said, when Russian pipeline was restored, it was a solution of the problem for a moment, and the others left as before. I mean, there was not a real discussion, real development in this direction.
So they haven't done much, even though they see the problem. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end of time, so I'm going to ask you both if you could give me your thoughts on where Turkish Central Asian relations are headed. Or Mukhtar, if you want to speak just specifically about Kazakh-Turkish relations, that's okay too. But so I'll start with you, Mukhtar. What do you see happening? You know, obviously the relationship is going much better than it has been in a long time. A lot of progress, a lot of momentum behind it. What are you looking for going in 2023 from Turkish Central Asian relations?
Yeah, as we discussed before, this is a chance, a real chance for Turkey to gain more from the Central Asian countries, and it's been using this momentum, and we are not aware, we don't know how long this war is going to last and what will be the result, and everything will depend on the outcome of this war. If the war the outcome will be not in favor of Russia, then of course this will help the Turkic states become more interconnected. But I think the biggest part of this relationship will be mostly economic, as we can see from this interruption in this chain through Russia. All the Central Asian countries are looking for other ways, and there is a China, a big market, and we are in the middle of this European, let's say, this Mediterranean and the Asian part. And this makes us a bridge between China and Turkey. And this is a moment for Turkic states to use this opportunity for the sake of unity. But in terms of the other sides, like, let's say, for example, the alphabet. Alphabet is one of the biggest questions in Kazakhstan, have been discussed before, and this kind of pan-Turkic side of it, I mean the political side of it, it remains more and more predictable, let's say. It will depend on the political developments, first of all, geopolitical developments.
Great. Thank you, Mukhtar. And Asel, also, how do you see Turkish Central Asian relations in 2023? And I'm going to throw in too, since Mukhtar brought it up. Does it make a difference that China will probably be supporting expansion of routes through Central Asia?
Okay, so could be. So let me just start with the idea that I definitely see that the energy exports are going to be on the agenda, rather than trade relations. I think Erdogan was pushing for $10 billion of trade, a mutual trade, but from 5 billion in the today. But I think it is very much unrealistic. So we will probably get transit fees, but I'm not sure that our exports, import operations and trade turnover in general would actually reach that desired 10 billion. But in terms of energy exports, yes, for sure, there will be some, I can see that there will be some decisions, strategic decisions done, may not necessarily be related to a commitment to a full pipeline, but nonetheless, some kind of transportation routes that bypasses Russia. And all of that would be introduced under stronger institutionalized auspices of the Organization of Turkic States that I do see will probably acquire additional functions, such as potentially economic cooperation, military cooperation, so that Turkey continues to supply Central Asian states with some of its military and weapon, some of its weapons, including drones, that as it did before. And in addition, I also see the fact that this particular Turkic Union is going to be a union where the local authoritarian leaders meet and decide. So it's a very kind of, it's a club rather than an organization where rulers who pretty much dominate over same type of political system and economic structure come together to decide what to do and how to safeguard not only their domestic legitimacy, but also ease the transnational opportunities for through cooperation. So, and the reason why I say that is because of recent Erdogan's policies towards domestic opposition. If you remember, he the High Court issued and accused the governor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, in violating the dignity, so to say, of the High Court judges. And also another case that is also on the agenda is the closure of HDP, HDP party, the pro-Kurdish party, and its accusations in supporting terrorism. So Turkey is moving towards, you know, to a club of authoritarian leaders in the post-Soviet states. Its politics is becoming much more, becoming similar. And It provides opportunity, it eases, so to say, activities and cooperation because you actually have the like-minded people around you. But at the same time, it doesn't. It's not necessarily good for the future of political transformation towards accountability, transparency, democracy, representation, and so on. So that's, I think, where the future is headed, at least in 2023.
All right. Thank you very much. And we have reached the end of the show. So a big thank you to Asel and Mukhtar for joining me and discussing.
Thank you for inviting us.
And of course, a thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting RFARL's website at rfarl.org. Thanks. And we'll be back next week. Bye bye, everybody.